The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us in the studio today for Campus Voices, we have two representatives of the University of Delaware's Engineers Without Borders chapter. On my right and your left.
Hi, my name is Sarah Hartman. I'm a current junior at the University of Delaware studying environmental engineering. Specifically, I concentrate in water quality and water resources. And I am one of the project managers for the University of Delaware chapter of Engineers Without Borders.
And sitting on my left.
My name is Kyle Lucina. I'm a senior chemical engineering major at the university. And I have minors in biochemical engineering and physics. And within the Engineers Without Borders program, I am the president of the University of Delaware chapter.
Aren't you on the Malawi team?
I am more involved in the Malawi project than the Philippines project. Yes.
And just to clarify, I'm the project manager for the Philippines project. So we have two projects going on right now.
But they're both water quality.
The Malawi project is geared more towards quantity and quality. So in Malawi, the issue is that most of the water is inaccessible most of the year. It either comes as rain during their rainy season, and then it's dry the rest of the year, or it comes from really, really deep groundwater. And then for the Philippines project, since the Philippines is a tropical island, they get plenty of water, but the issue is that their water is contaminated with fecal contamination.
The Malawi project is a year ahead of the Philippines project, Kyle?
Yes, that's correct. That's only because we started about a year prior to choosing the Philippines project. So we were working on a project in Cameroon, which was also a water supply system, and a bridge in Guatemala. And both of those ended at the same time in 2013. And then the first community that we identified thereafter was a community in Malawi. And after we were a year into that project, we decided that we had the resources and the capabilities to take on a second project. And that's when we started looking into multiple other opportunities, and we ended up choosing the Philippines.
Why don't you talk a little bit about the whole process? Because I don't want our listeners to think, oh, these kids just decided to go to Malawi or the Philippines and muck around in the water.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Sarah?
Yeah, sure. So I've actually been involved with picking the Philippines project. That was my initial role. And I think it's a really great question that you bring up is how do we pick these communities? Because there are plenty of deserving communities around the world that need help with some sort of engineering design. And the whole process of picking these communities is actually somewhat complex. And it generally takes us upwards of a year to pick a community. Because when we make a commitment with a community, it's for a minimum of 5 years. So we promise to help this community for 5 years. And when we're looking for a community to partner with, there are a lot of factors that go into the partnership. So you're looking at the commitment of the community. So did the community reach out to us? Have they proven to us that they are invested in not only a short-term project, but in a sustainable project that will continue long after we've left? Do we see that motivation, that drive, that enthusiasm? Is there another group within the home country, within that community that can help us? There are a lot of logistics that go into traveling abroad and then building some sort of engineering project abroad. So are we going to have that support in country? Another very practical consideration is safety. So we have to make sure we're traveling to safe countries. And that's a University of Delaware requirement. It's also an Engineers Without Borders USA requirement. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is, do we think that we are capable of helping that community? So can we use our engineering skills to improve the lives of that community? All of that's a very long process. So that's why there was that 1 year gap between the Malawi and Philippines projects.
Engineers Without Borders has a national organization. They get involved with our chapter's projects as well, do they not?
Everything we do, we report back to them. So we are a chapter underneath Engineers Without Borders USA. And because of that, we have to follow a lot of protocol. Before any trip or any design is implemented, we have to get the approval of Engineers Without Borders USA. And they actually are very aware of the turnover of students, and they've established some safeties into their program. So they created programs that are specifically designed to look at the long term. So how can students transfer information from one group of students to the next? And so we get a lot of really good resources out of the national chapter. They provide very valuable feedback on everything that we do. And they actually help us find mentors. So we have a couple ways that we find mentors. One would be through Engineers Without Borders USA. We also like to look through our alumni network. The University of Delaware has been very helpful and gracious in helping us find some technical professional, either engineers or other types of professionals that can help us with the design of our projects.
I think that's one of the things that impressed me when I talked to some of your predecessors in Engineers Without Borders, is there really is a sense of community in the engineering community that goes beyond UD.
Well, we've received an immense amount of support from the local community beyond just professionals at the University of Delaware. We have worked with professionals from Philadelphia and other surrounding cities within the state and without the state, and they've been instrumental in giving us the expertise that we need, because as students, we don't have all the knowledge required to implement a well in a country like Malawi or the Philippines. So that means we have to work with people who are experts in these fields, and we do that through a lot of different contacts that we make.
And I think it's really been surprising but also inspiring by how many people have held on to the idea of Engineers Without Borders and who have specifically helped out Engineers Without Borders at the University of Delaware. So we still get mentorship from some of the founding students who saw the Cameroon project through. And that's been really inspiring, just to see where they've gone with their experience with Engineers Without Borders, and also to see that even after they've graduated, they still find the value in coming back and mentoring new students as they can help communities around the world.
Now, I want you both to take a little bit of time explaining the overview of a project. It's not just like last year you guys head over to Malawi with your shovels, and this year you headed over to the Philippines with your drill bits. Tell us about the overall project, because Malawi is 1 year ahead in the process, but that's good to hear where both of your projects are.
So part of the requirement in working with Engineers Without Borders USA is to submit reports. We have to do that before we travel, after we travel, and whenever we develop some sort of technical solution for the community that we're working with. EWB USA does not complete projects itself in the way that each of the chapters that are part of EWB USA does. EWB USA is strictly an overseeing organization. So we report to them, and their job is to support us in doing our projects. But EWB USA does not itself do projects. But whenever we submit one of these reports, with it, we have to submit a detailed itinerary of everything we plan to do day by day. That can include the individuals we're going to contact, the type of technical data that we're going to collect from the community, and different resources that we're going to look for. Generally, the projects consist of three phases. The first is the assessment phase, where we are figuring out what exactly is the scale of our project. The second is the implementation phase, where we are developing a solution and putting it into the community. And then the third, which I think is something that distinguishes the sustainability of EWB from other organizations, is we do a monitoring phase, where we go back to the community after everything has been fully implemented and observe how the community is adapting the technology and work with them to troubleshoot any issues that they may be having. So right now, Malawi completed their second assessment trip, and they're looking to move into an implementation phase. So our goal on this past trip to the country was to meet as many professional well drillers, as many professional tank suppliers as we could. We wanted to talk to individuals from a local college who may have special knowledge on the geography of the region and the type of groundwater that exists in the village that we're looking at. We also wanted to contact the village chiefs in the area that we are working in, because we need to make sure that we're not instigating some sort of political issue by working in one village. We don't want to be giving a strong advantage to one village and then disadvantaging the villages around it. So we need to make sure this communication is open, not only between us and the village that we work with, but the villages around the villages that we work with. And that was the focus of our last trip to Malawi.
That's actually a very interesting point. I mean, Sarah, you told me when we met before we sat down in the studio that both the Philippines Project and the Malawi Project end up being working with groups of five small villages.
Yeah, so it's important to take into account all of the groups that will be affected by your design. So like Kyle mentioned, in Malawi, there's actually a cluster of communities that all are close together. So it's important to understand the needs of those communities. In the Philippines, we look a lot at the protocol we have to follow. So we went on our first assessment trip this August. And when we went there, we were careful to make sure we met with all of the important groups in helping ensure that the project would be successful. So, of course, we interviewed community members. So we made sure to go to all ends of the community, not just where the clusters of people were. And that actually gave us a lot of insight into the different needs in different parts of the community. And then we also met with some of the other local leaders to kind of understand where they were and what sort of needs they had. And while we are focusing on helping one community, we want to be able to provide the other communities with the resources they would need to improve their standard of living. We also met with some government leaders. So in the Philippines, there's a lot of permit work that has to be done in order to do certain types of designs. So you really have to keep in mind the practicality of a design and the time frame that it takes to not only design what it is you want to build, but also how long it's going to take to get that design improved in country.
What stood out in your experience going overseas?
So I guess it was something I wasn't necessarily prepared for. Before we went over to the Philippines, we were preparing for all of the technical collection. We were preparing to meet with the community. So to some extent, we were preparing for both the technical and the social side. But while we were there, like I said, we tested over 14 sites for water quality. And test after test, we kept getting back results that would not be acceptable in America. Test after test, we were getting poor water quality results. And that in itself was very disturbing. We knew that their water wasn't good. But what was the hardest part was we had been asked to test the water at the elementary school, so where children kindergarten to maybe sixth grade are playing. And so we go there, and the children are crowding around us. They're looking at our probes. They're looking at our testing equipment, trying to touch it, and we try to make sure they don't touch anything. And the group got silent because as we were doing these tests, test after test, we were getting the worst water quality results we had seen in the entire community.
At the school?
At the school. And, you know, we were stunned into silence because the children were right there. And the teachers were popping their heads out of classrooms, trying to see what was going on. And everyone was so excited. And we didn't know what to tell them because we knew these children drank the water. And so we quietly told the teachers the children probably shouldn't be drinking this water. And then when we had to present our results to the community council, and we told them site after site for over 14 sites that their water quality was not fit for drinking. It was one of the hardest experiences. And that's not something you can really prepare for beforehand. And telling them that and then coming back here was very, very painful because we had to leave after telling them that all of their water was bad. We had to leave without giving them the resources. And I think it's maybe the fear that we saw in their eyes and just the knowledge that their water is so poor. And that's why we work so hard. That's why we go back, because we have the knowledge. So to some extent, we have the responsibility to improve the lives of these communities.
Kyle?
One of the moments that impacted me the most when we were in Malawi occurred toward the end of our trip. And EWB USA requires that we sign a project partnership agreement. So this is a formal way of saying that the community that we're working with will support us in the specific ways that the agreement requests. So this is an agreement between EWB UD, the community, and also a non-governmental organization in the community. And we work with an excellent non-governmental organization called Villages in Partnership. They've supported us immensely, and they've given us a lot of really fantastic experiences there. Well, they've been in the community longer than we have, and one of the community members said toward the end of our trip that they are really thankful for our presence there, because even in the short time that Villages in Partnership has been in the community, they've seen drastic changes there. And she said one of the ways that they've seen changes is because previously, the only time a vehicle would come into the village was an ambulance to take away a dead body or someone who was sick. But now, since Villages in Partnership has started working with them, more vehicles come into the community, and they're Villages in Partnership trucks. So they're vehicles that are coming to help and give aid and to support the community. And that is a sign of hope that she identified. And she said, your presence here and your partnership with Villages in Partnership and with us as a community, it goes even further to support our hope and encourage us for the future. And that was a really shocking insight into what the life can be like in this community. It's not every day that something so dismal is happening, but it reveals the isolation that they have and all the ways that we are able to help them having the resources that we have here in the United States.
I think Dean Okonike would be very proud of both of you, because you're talking about engineering not just as solving a technical problem, but finding a creative way to help people.
Yeah, that's correct. One of the huge advantages I've seen to working with Engineers Without Borders is that the projects span way beyond the technical realm and enter into all these different disciplines as far as how we're going to work with people who don't speak our language, how we're going to work with people whose primary objective in life is to produce a high crop yield, not to, you know, send their kids to college or to enjoy all these comforts that we have living in the United States. These are people who are identical to us in that they work really hard. They have the same sorts of ambitions as us, and they have a lot of the same mindsets and even some of the same beliefs, but they just execute all the parts of their life in a very different environment, a different social environment, a different natural environment, a different political environment. And so when we work with these communities through Engineers Without Borders, we get to engage in all these different levels, not just in installing, you know, a pump and calculating how much pressure needs to be generated by a certain pump to deliver water to X number of households. The problem is much bigger than that.
Sarah, you told me that you've been using Facebook, of all things, to communicate with the people back in the Philippines.
Yeah, so that's actually something that was really funny. So before we went, we really only had one main contact, and we would email her. And then after we went, we found out that not only is Facebook free to use over there, but that everyone, virtually everyone in the community, has a phone that has Facebook capability. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about smartphones, but they are able to keep up with us. And I have actually spoken to them every single week, if not multiple times a week, with multiple members of both the local government and of a water council that the community created. So that can be a lot of fun. They've been sending us a lot of pictures of updates of what they've been doing. So when we left, we gave them recommendations on how they could clean their existing water supplies. And Facebook has made it possible to not only have this exchange of information, maybe they can ask us questions if there's something they don't understand, but they're also able to update us. And the enthusiasm that we're getting from everything that they're sending over is just so reassuring. And going back to that fundamental idea of how we pick a community, you know, this is exactly what we want to see. Not only are they engaged with the project, but they're excited to show us that they're engaged. And they're trying to complete as much as they can, even when we're not there. So it's just been a wonderful thing to see.
I think it's really cool. It sounds like the idea is we're not just great consultants from America coming to show you what to do and leaving. It's we're trying to get you involved in the project so that you can continue it.
Yeah, that's a mindset that EWB USA maintains. They say that the project has to be community driven from the beginning to the end. And that's because we don't want to lose sight of the fact that we are there for 5 or 6 or 7 years, which may seem like a long time to us, but in terms of the community, that's not a lot at all. These are people who are going to be relying on this fundamental technology for the rest of their life if the project can be implemented well and successfully. So having the community heavily invested from the very beginning is important to enabling them to really take ownership of the project so that they can maintain it even while we're gone.
What is contaminating the water in Malawi?
They do have some pesticide use. So is arsenic a common chemical in pesticides?
Not in common ones, because it's poisonous.
But it's one of the things that have to deal with the contamination. But the thing they have to deal with in Malawi is the fact that you get too much water and then you get no water for 11 months. So you have to really look hard for it. And you guys have got some cool technology you've been using to help them predict where to dig wells.
Yes. So one of the main issues with Malawi is they have two wells that they currently try to use. One is very shallow, so it goes only a couple meters deep underground. And that well, its biggest issue is that it can get contaminated with human bacterial waste. So the same sort of fecal coliform that was observed in the Philippines is also present in Malawi. Now, on the other hand, and the exact opposite extreme of that is they have a borehole well that goes very deep. So that goes maybe 40 meters underground, which is typical depth for a borehole well. However, they've found that the well goes dry during the dry season. It doesn't have a large enough water reserve to supply it throughout the whole year. So one way that we try to understand the profile of the water tables underground is to use resistivity testing equipment. So water has a much higher resistivity than the rock or the earth around it. And on the other hand, if you come across solid rock, that has extremely high resistivity. So we can apply a voltage to these copper rods that we stick into the ground, and that will send an electric current through the earth, and we can record that on two different probes that are closer together. And we can progressively increase the distance between these outer rods, and the further apart they are, the deeper the current will travel underground. And then if we see the resistance suddenly spike, that could mean that we've hit a layer of bedrock. And normally what's found is a layer of fractured bedrock that rests right above the solid bedrock. So when it rains, that fractured bedrock fills with water. And those are the water reserves that you want to tap into for a borehole well. However, what we're finding in Malawi is that there's very little to no fractured bedrock. So that means the soil goes from dirt, like you would normally see, and then transitions almost immediately to solid rock.
So the water just runs off underground.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that we could find a water aquifer below the solid bedrock, or at least much deeper than is normally required to reach it. But that presents a lot of challenges because it's very difficult to drill up to 60 meters deep, which is the depth that some people believe we have to drill to find water.
In the Philippines, the problem isn't finding the water.
Right. From everything that we've learned, they really never run out of water. It's just that the sources that they have are all contaminated. So when we went on our trip, we tested over 14 sites, and everywhere that we tested, we found that there was fecal contamination in the water. So that's a huge concern. In the United States, any fecal bacteria in water supply is unacceptable for drinking. And so that in itself, beyond looking at the other parameters that we tested, is an issue of concern. And what we think is happening is, so the island is based on a coral limestone structure. And what happens with limestone is over time, these small fissures will form. And over time, the fissures all connect. So we think that underground, there's this large matrix of small fissures that are connecting. And the current sanitation system in the community is virtually a hole that's dug into the ground. And so we think that when they go to the bathroom, that fecal matter is percolating through the soil and then reaching the groundwater. And since all of the groundwater is connected because of the limestone nature of the water, that's causing fecal contamination virtually everywhere in the community. And so we plan to do one more trip, an assessment trip, where we'll be testing the water supply as well as doing other tests. And we want to look at this again to see if that indeed is correct, if the fecal contamination is a result of the sanitation system.
We're talking today with Kyle and Sarah, two of the student members of the Engineers Without Borders chapter here at the University of Delaware. And Kyle is representing the entire chapter as current president, but also representing the Malawi group. And Sarah is one of the project managers for the Philippines group. How do you guys raise money for this? Do you sell cookies?
Well, I was a Girl Scout for 13 years, so I would be well qualified for that.
That's an important resource. We should tap into that. Well, our primary means for raising money is to contact corporations and to gain their support, which we've done through really fantastic partnerships. We received donations from companies like Air Products and Bentley Systems. And we also have a lot of support from the University of Delaware's College of Engineering. So they're helping us to expand those fundraising efforts. One of the primary ways that we reach out to corporations is through an event that we hold every spring. It's called the Benefit Dinner. This year, it will be on the university's campus in the new Integrated Science and Engineering Building. And it'll be on Friday, April 22nd.
Of 2016.
2016, yes. So if you're interested in anything that we do, that would be an excellent event to come out to and learn about recent updates in our projects, future plans, and ways that you can be involved. We've had professionals who come to this event contact us, and they are now working with us as technical advisors, and some of them even get to travel with us and see the communities firsthand and lend their expertise in a whole new way. So that's one of the primary ways that we fundraise and gain support, but we also hold a lot of on-campus events to raise awareness on the campus community, and that is beneficial because we gain some money, but we also gain dedicated students who are willing to extend our efforts.
You guys are glad to take people from all through the College of Engineering, and you may even have some who are from other colleges.
Yeah, we really encourage that because everything that we do isn't engineering. So there's, even just from this discussion today, perhaps you hear that, you know, there's a lot of money matters. There's a lot of public relations. You're dealing with political issues, social issues. We do a lot of education. So really, we welcome students from any discipline because what we do is so multidisciplinary. Engineers are trained to do calculations. They're trained to design something. But there's so much more than just the design.
So far, what would you say are the top two things you've each learned from your involvement with Engineers Without Borders here at the University of Delaware?
One of the top things I've learned and I've been inspired by is seeing how eagerly students from the university and community members outside the university will support our organization and our efforts. So it's not because of who we are, it's because of the work that we're doing and the nature of helping individuals across the world. Something about that is really attractive and really captivates people's interest. So that's been really inspirational to see. And I've learned that students and professionals both will willingly contribute their time and do whatever is needed to complete a given project or to finish a report on time or whatever the case may be. The second thing I've learned is on the other end of the project, which is in the community. So I've also seen firsthand the way that villagers are willing to sacrifice their time simply to watch what we're doing. So they may not understand the techniques that we're using or all the background data that we are collecting or even why we need to collect it, but they're so engaged in our presence there and they're so interested in what we have to give to them that they're willing just to sit in the field in the hot sun and watch us tinker with instruments and dig into their soil or run through their crops or do whatever it has to be done.
Sarah?
Well, I would say that Engineers Without Borders kind of defines my university experience. It's been a huge component of my education. As an environmental engineer, what I am learning in classes is directly applicable to what I'm doing for the Philippines project. And that has been an incredible experience because I can take something that I learn and I can leave the classroom and that day I can use that information to help a community. And it puts a face on what we're doing and it really brings value to my education because I see a tangible application of how I can use my education to help the world.
Thank you so much, Kyle and Sarah. And thank you to everybody in the Engineers Without Borders family.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.